Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Now on Food FM, you're listening to Bread and Butter with Caroline Kenyon. Caroline and her guests make sense of the world through food, from politics to farming, making and cooking.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Hello, it's Caroline Kenyon here from Bread and Butter, and I have a very special guest today. It's Gillian Calouette-Noble from the Sustainable Restaurant Association. Welcome, Gillian.
Hello.
It's so lovely to have you.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to be talking to you.
And we're going to be talking about one of my favourite things, which is about food and family, because I know you have a big campaign going on. Well, first of all, Gillian, let's just go back to the beginning. Just tell us a little bit about the Sustainable Restaurant Association, because
yes,
I know about it, but I know that quite a lot of people who are not in the food industry don't necessarily know so much. So
yes,
tell us what it is.
Of course. Let me start there. So the Sustainable Restaurant Association in some ways does what it says on the tin. We work with restaurants around sustainability issues. So we were founded in London almost 15 years ago now. We were originally founded by two sustainability consultants, Giles Gibbons and Simon Heppner, and two restaurateurs, Henry Dimbleby and Mark Sainsbury. That if you kind of rewind your mind back 15 years and think about what sustainability meant in the industry, there wasn't nearly as much conversation as there is today. And instead, the origin of the conversation was really saying, we're seeing this increase in corporate social responsibility in the corporate world. We're seeing an increase in what was the beginnings of conscious consumerism. So the kind of rise of consumers searching out organic products and, looking for sustainability labels like MSC on seafood and others in supermarkets. And yet it felt like when it came to restaurants, there wasn't really any guidance or support for the industry. So here we have a sector where pretty much every sustainability issue that you can think about globally comes together and hits the hospitality sector. So whether we're talking about, food and farming, whether you're talking about energy use and energy cost, whether you're talking about social sustainability and employment and good quality employment, hospitality is a hotbed for all of these issues. But nobody was really out there doing a good job at kind of helping restaurants and hospitality businesses get connected to what actions they should be taking. So Sustainable Restaurant Association formed. And the key thing that we do is have a framework for hospitality businesses. It's called the Food Made Good Framework. And it helps to break down sustainability issues into 10 key areas for hospitality businesses to tackle. Now, alongside that framework, we then have an accreditation, the Food Made Good accreditation, where businesses can, every 2 years, businesses complete an audit. They submit information around what they're doing in each of these areas, and they come out of that with one star, two star, or three stars, just like the Michelin stars, where you've got a recognition of good practice, great practice, and excellent practice when it comes to sustainability.
Wonderful. What a brilliant resume. Thank you, Gillian. And I feel like I've got a really good handle on it now. Firstly,
great,
just to say how prescient to set it up in 2010. And it could not feel more urgent now in the context of the state of the world climatically, geopolitically, really, really critical work that you're doing. And it's
100%. And I think this moment that we find ourselves in is really one where sustainability has moved from being something really kind of low down on the risk register or something that only a certain type of restaurant cared about, one that was self-identifying as a sustainable restaurant, to now being something that is absolutely essential across the industry, no matter what type of restaurant you are, no matter what type of food business. This is actually all incredibly important to future-proofing your business to be able to continue to operate. Because as businesses that serve food, we are the most at risk to some of the instabilities of the climate. We are the most at risk to some of these instabilities of the geopolitical situation, like you've mentioned. We are the most at risk to the movement of people, and the fact that we've, you know, undergone this staffing crisis within our industry in the last few years post-COVID. So these are all actually now not even just quote unquote sustainability issues. They're just good business issues for our industry to address.
Absolutely. Well, they're critical to the survival of the industry, really. Exactly. I mean, I find it quite fascinating how few people know, for example, what the carbon emissions are from food. And it's, you know, 30% of all carbon emissions, which is enormous.
Exactly. And it's funny to think, you know, that most people assume that, you know, travel is the largest impact in their life, and they'll make decisions or they'll make a choice for more sustainable travel, which is absolutely brilliant, but without entirely recognizing that actually the food that you're choosing ultimately has a bigger impact. And so we need to collectively shift our thinking around food. And I personally believe that a lot of that comes from restaurants and the role that chefs and, you know, and restaurants have in terms of influencing beyond the front doors of a restaurant and beyond just their tables. You know, creating new ideas, fads, ways of thinking about food. Restaurants are hugely influential in our lives in that way. And that can then trickle down beyond the restaurant into our homes.
I think that's a lovely segue, Julian, for us to talk about your campaign, which is Food and Eating and Family. So tell us about that.
Yes. So this summer, we're running a campaign that's called The Power of Food. And I think one of the things that when we talk about being an organization, a sustainability organization, I think most people immediately think around the environmental impact. And they mostly think about things like energy, water, food waste is a big one that people come to us about, or the sourcing of the ingredients. But actually, we fundamentally believe that sustainability is holistic, and that social impact is a huge piece of the role that restaurants play in and that food plays in the world. So The Power of Food is really a campaign to highlight that social impact and that ability for food to bring people together and to make a real difference in lives. And so the first half of this campaign is really focusing on the power of food and family. And that's both the benefits of cooking with your children, of passing on that knowledge of food to your children and deepening those relationships around food. And also thinking more broadly around the ways in which your parents or your grandparents or your aunts and uncles, you know, the kind of not just up or not just down to your children, but also up and back and cooking with your parents and gathering that knowledge from your grandmothers and your grandfathers can have a real power to strengthening the bonds within a family and improving the health of a family.
I love all of that. And you're certainly preaching to the converted there, Julian, because I absolutely adore cooking. In fact, everybody in my family does. And we all come at it from a sort of different angle. My husband's a brilliant cook. His uncle was the first TV chef, a man called Philip Harbin.
Oh, wow.
And my mother-in-law was an amazing cook, home cook.
Amazing.
I love cooking. I'm not brilliant, but I love it. My son is vegan. My stepdaughter is a doctor and very keen on nutrition. So we all cook. We all love eating. We love eating together. So, but that is not the case for very many people. And I think it's really interesting, Julian. I'd love to know what you think about this. But to a degree, it's like the sort of those who have least and sometimes those who have most.
Yeah.
Who don't have that family community eating together. And just, you know, to illustrate, I'm quite involved on it in a voluntary way in the realm of food poverty, which one might really call poverty. Mm. And often people, they don't cook because they can't afford a saucepan or they can't afford to turn the cooker on. So that's one thing. And so they will eat fast food and everybody will choose their own fast food because that's just the way that they survive. But at the other end of the spectrum, I'll just give you an example. Overheard in a ladies' loo in southwest London the other day, I went to a lovely concert at Kew Gardens. very, very privileged audience with very smart picnics. And there were two women in the ladies' loo talking to each other about their teenage children and what they'd left them to eat that evening. And one of them said, oh, I took my son round the supermarket and I let him choose. And he chose pizza and mango. Mango, mango, mango. I have neither the patience nor the inclination for mango. And I've been sort of half laughing and half enraged ever since. Yeah. And to me, that family never ate together. So yeah. I love what you're doing. Sorry, that's a rather long response to talking about. But it's what's happened to our society that we don't value eating together. Is it uniquely British?
So as an American, I think I can confirm that it's not uniquely British. I think that we are seeing this, this has happened over generations in a number of places. And I actually think that, as an American, I think we can put our hands up and claim some responsibility a bit here because of the sort of Americanification of diets around the world and the pushing of an industrial food system. The one thing that I would say, so I moved to England 13 years ago, and the main reason that I moved was because I was really inspired by the work of Jamie Oliver and the School Dinners campaign. And I came to England to work for Jamie, and I spent the first 5 years of my career here in London. I worked on school food and school food policy with Jamie. And I think the thing that I think is so incredibly valuable around the mission, and the work that Jamie kind of kicked off all those years ago, was pushing the idea that a school meal can be a real equalizer, and a school meal is a communal moment for every child in this country, and that we need to reconnect our understanding and our love of food, and that the universal way to do that is through schools. And I think when you go to that question about how do we get families to eat together, and whether you're talking about the high end, or the low end of income schemes, I think fundamentally that comes from a value and an appreciation of food, which was lost over the last, few generations. And as food became increasingly cheap and devalued in our system, as it became incredibly easy to microwave things and to pick things up, we have driven down and down and down the value of food and the cost of food. At the same time, something else has always been willing to sort of step in its place. And so, whether that's an increase in the amount of time we spend in front of screens, or an increase of the amount of money that we spend on housing, that makes it now feel impossible. Like, how could we spend more money on food, or how could we spend more time together? We don't have time and we don't have money. But actually, it is around what our culture values and how we can make those adjustments. And I think, it's as pertinent today as it was 15 years ago when I first kind of started these conversations in my career, is that schools are really, really valuable, and childhood is a really valuable opportunity to build those skills and to start that conversation.
Wonderful. So tell me how the campaign is working, Julian. How are you going to communicate and encourage families to eat together?
So first of all, we have been launching this campaign in partnership with HSBC. And so we've got the support of a global partner that's helping us grow that message across multiple countries. So, we're talking here about the British experience, but actually the time spent, in cultures across the world are experiencing the same thing, where people are spending less and less time together, eating together and celebrating. So we're working with chefs, and we're working with food influencers in not only the UK, but also in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Dubai, and across the kind of Middle East, and really building that conversation on using social media. So using an opportunity to tell stories, to pass recipes, and to encourage people to post their own experiences of cooking with their children. And it's been really incredible to see here in the UK, we've worked with over the last couple of weeks, we've posted with Georgie Hayden, and who obviously her books and her experience talks quite a lot around the knowledge that she has learned as a chef from her grandmothers, from her yayas, and passing those traditions on to her young daughters. We have worked with Chetna McCann, who cooked with her daughter and posted a really lovely story of cooking together. And most recently, we've had Melissa Thompson post a reel where she was cooking with her parents and showing that sort of intergenerational connection. And I think one of the things that's been lovely to see is the comments and the amount of people that have jumped in to the comments to say, wow, this reminds me of my childhood, or this is what it was like with my grandmother, or, you know, and inspiring people to say, that reminds me, I need to play a role in passing this on to the next generation because this brings up such great memories for me.
That's so lovely. I have to say, I did slightly giggle to myself while you were speaking, Julian, because my parents came from quite different backgrounds. My father came from a very privileged background, and his mother never cooked because she had a cook. And my mother did not come from a privileged background, and her mother hated cooking. And I remember her as a child, that the kitchen was a kind of place of fear and dread. And when she found tinned vegetables, she was so happy because all she had to do was pick them up. My mother was a highly competent cook, but never confident. So I really learnt it for myself.
Yeah. And I think that's the other thing too, right? Is that you're not alone in that. There are plenty of us out there that kind of have had to learn that for ourselves. And, you know, that sort of leads into the next part of the campaign in a way, which is that beyond just the family, food has a role to bring communities together. The role of the chosen family in cooking, and it can be a really powerful piece of this as well, and how you pass those skills on if you have learned it for yourself. And so this, looking at this community aspect, one of the things that we're really trying to highlight is where chefs and restaurants are, you know, empowering new people to get into kitchens or to get engaged with food as a way that then ricochets and creates community impact. So the first of those stories was of Luminary Bakery, and obviously the amazing work that Luminary does in passing those skills on to women that really empowers them with not only a job in the immediate term, but then skills to pass on and to, you know, to gain employment. And hospitality and food can be a really powerful place for those skills and for disadvantaged groups to find community and to find opportunity and to create that social impact.
Yes, that's so interesting, because really, for many people nowadays, their community is their family. I mean, family is used in a very kind of narrow, specific way.
Yes.
But I mean, I know in City of Westminster, for example, more than 50% of people live by themselves.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, very high percentage. And we do, I think, is it 1 in 4 people, adults in this country, live on their own?
Wow, yeah, yeah.
So, and friends are the new family or your community. I mean, it might be just the lady at the corner shop that you see once a week when you go to pick up your newspaper and a pint of milk.
But that's, it's so your community. Important, because as you're talking about that, you know, it's then not a surprise that we have an epidemic of loneliness in this country. And I think, you know, studies are now repeatedly showing that loneliness can have the impact on our health that smoking for your whole life can have. And so actually it's really fundamental. Humans are social creatures, and coming together around food and finding those connections is actually something that's really fundamental to our health going forward. And, you know, I've just returned from some time away, and it really reminded me that the blue zones in the world, so the places in the world where people live the longest, right? You've got these pockets all around the world. And one of them is Sardinia. And there's lots of exploration that's gone into the blue zones and what are the different diets in these regions. And there's actually quite a lot of variety of what those diets are. There's a lot of, you know, one person might say there's no dairy in a diet, and then you go to a place like Sardinia and there's actually quite a lot of goat's cheese and milk in the diet. And one person might say lots of fish, and then you go to another place and there's not a lot of fish. So it's not actually the food that ends up being the commonalities. There ended up there's research done on what those commonalities are. And community is one of the biggest commonalities that leads to people living longer. And so whether that's, you know, old men sitting in a square playing a game of cards or a game of, you know, bulls or bocce or whatever it might be called, finding that community is really important. And food has the real power to do that. And, you know, another personal story, when I first left university, I moved to New York City, and I'm from California, and, you know, New York is all of those things, that big city and that isolated, you know, can be all of those isolating things. And we used to do what we called a family dinner on Sunday nights at my apartment, which was for a bunch of strays like me, you know, people that didn't have family that lived in New York and that came together and cooked on a Sunday night. And you start to build those connections and build those networks. And I think out of that family dinner spawned family dinners in, you know, as people went on to their own lives in different places, spawned those newer communities. And you can have a real connection through sharing a meal.
Absolutely. It's quite interesting. I don't know if you've seen in the press recently, there's been quite a lot about the right to eat by yourself in a restaurant on your own.
Yes.
Which,
yes.
Of course, I completely salute.
Yes.
But for me, and sometimes I do, because I'm out and about and running a business, yes. And I'm not all, but I, you know, and if I were in a different family circumstance, I would think, yeah, why not?
Yes.
But
yes, and I
it's
think
such, you know, a pleasure to eat with other people and to discuss what you're eating and maybe share it and all of those things.
Exactly. And I think absolutely that, you know, we want spaces that people can access, and we, you know, and then as restaurants, we want to be accessible and open. So that ability for people to come in on their own is important to creating that environment in which people are able to access, anybody is able to access a restaurant. But again, even that, actually, I would say if you're dining alone in a restaurant, you're not actually truly alone, are you? Because you have those interactions, you have those servers, you have that connection. And potentially that's another place to say restaurants are a place where you can be alone amongst others and, you know, and help to, again, find that bridge to some community.
I can really identify with that. I moved to the countryside when my son was a 5-day-old baby and my husband was still working in London. So I was alone and lonely a lot.
Alone.
And I used to go to, there was a nearby supermarket with a cafe where you had free baby food and free newspapers. So I used to pop him in the high chair.
It's so powerful.
And a cup of coffee, because there were people around me.
Yeah, it's so powerful. I mean, it's so interesting because, that resonates with me a lot. And mothers that in my network, that really the value of a supermarket cafe in that way, when they were kind of losing their minds by themselves with a young baby. I think the value of these spaces, I think, can't be overstated on our mental health and on our culture. Do you know what I mean? I think restaurants, I was actually just before this call, I was speaking to a restaurateur and we were talking about how are things going in the restaurants. And obviously it's a difficult context out there in which restaurants are operating. And I think that one of the things that we all as citizens need to remember is that if we want these spaces to remain, you know, we need to engage with them. We need to dine out and we need to participate because we don't want, and it's the same way with, you know, shopping locally and all of that, where we don't want our high streets to be entirely abandoned and we don't want our only food options to be from behind a delivery platform. We need to engage in a world which still allows for these vibrant cities that we live in and these vibrant communities.
I love all of that, Julie. And I'm going to throw you a little curveball. So let's say you were going to have a family lunch or supper tomorrow. Who would you invite and what would you cook?
So my mom is currently visiting from California. So I have her in town And I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, and my husband who lives with me. So I would absolutely be getting my 4-year-old and my 6-year-old involved in preparing the meal. And we've just come home, and I think this sort of, as much as this rain has not been a lovely summer for people here in London, I think the garden has enjoyed the sunshine and the rain. And though I live in central London, I've got a small plot, about a meter squared. And we've got some courgettes in the garden at the moment that are still in that kind of young and tender stage. And then have those nice, lovely courgette flowers that are so vibrant right now. So I think that's a really great way to get your kids involved, is even if you don't have much space, like I don't, you know, growing something, kids feel really empowered when it's something that they have grown and participated in. And that act of going out and picking it makes them feel this whole new level of ownership over that. So I think those would need to feature on our menu somewhere. So maybe we're stuffing those courgette flowers and then using the courgette itself, which is sort of leading me down a Italian kind of road for this meal. And then in this hypothetical world, I think I would be looking at, we've got two close families in our neighborhood where our children are friends, and really kind of build out that backbone of the fact that it's really difficult to parent on your own these days. You need a community of parents around you to be able to manage life with small children. So I think we would probably be, hopefully the sun would come out, we would eat lunch in the garden, and it would be my mom, my boys, and then kind of our two neighbors as well coming around for a meal.
That sounds delightful, Gillian, and I'd love to be there too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I've so enjoyed our conversation.
Really wonderful. Thank you.
And here's to eating together as family and friends.
Exactly. Cheers to that.
You're listening to Bread and Butter with Caroline Kenyon.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.